Started. So here, I'm sharing my screen. We're going to get started on Stuka right now. This is a very exciting, fresh new Sugya. Now, I'm going to just say a few things by general way of introduction. This is not meant to be a general introduction to the Sugya. This is really just meant to raise four questions for us to consider as we start wading into the Sugya. But I intentionally don't want to cloud our discussion by foregrounding all of the central questions up front. I think it'll be too confusing. So I want us to wade in slowly, and I'm just going to give a few guiding questions today, and we'll get into our discussion. Then I'll raise further introductory questions and subtopics as we get further in. So I just want to say first, al derech hakdama, that this sugya of tzedakah raises again some very fundamental questions of halacha and the philosophy of halacha, and how Judaism thinks about basic questions of society. Seems to be a recurring theme in these sugyas in the first parak of Bava Basra, right? Who knew? Right, you could be learning about Cheskes Abadim, or you could be learning about Yesodos. I'm just kidding. It's a cheap shot. So the first topic, the first question, the guiding question is, what does halacha think, or what do we think about wealth in general, and what role it plays in society? Obviously, the question of tzedakah is very much related to that. When it starts thinking about the, or I should put it this way, what did the obligations of tzedakah reflect about the way the halacha thinks about wealth in general? So we're going to encounter that in a few places, but I want to frame that as question number one. Question number two is, why should the wealthy people, the Ashirim, have any responsibilities towards the Aniyim? Now, obviously, there's a sense in which the answer to that is obvious or straightforward, but I just want to be explicit about that question because there are many different ways to answer it. So again, why should the Ashirim have any responsibilities to the Aniyim? Okay. That's question number two. Question number three is, what are, in terms of substance, like what are the set of goods that the Aniyim are entitled to? This will come up explicitly in today's discussion. Is it just a certain amount of money? Is it to have other goods? So what are the set of things that the Ashirim are obligated to supply to the Aniyim, or correlatively, if you accept the argument about rights, to which set of entitlements do the Aniyim have the right to? Number four, as an accompanying question, I want us to start thinking about the placement of tzedakah for the various Rishonim and their codes. Where does tzedakah get codified by the Mechabrim? Who knows? Where does tzedakah get codified? Go for it, Daniel.
Was it Choshen
Good try, but no, not in Choshen Mishpat. But it's natural. You might have thought Choshen Mishpat. That's a very good guess. But I like how you answered it in Jeopardy question form.
I mean, I wasn't sure, that's why.
Yeah, I know. So where does stuck up here, guys? Anybody want to help out Daniel?
You're there.
Yeah, your day, exactly. It's an interesting question. Why some things get put in Choshen Mishpat, why do other things get put in your day? Ribis is an interesting example where Ribis appears in your day. Tzedakah is another instance. So why is tzedakah put in your day rather than Choshen Mishpat? You might think it's a question like Rashan b'nei ir la'asiyal kitzasan. It's a question of hilchashchenim. Right? It's dine mamonis for sure in some sense. So why does this get relegated to Yerida? Anybody have any suggestions off the top of their head? No? Okay. Anything come to mind? Ned, you must have some theory. Nothing off the top of your head? Okay. Anybody have a Benji?
Yeah, I mean, you could say like what the Christians do about how or meaning if you say that you're really serving God and God like through a mechanism of helping someone else, then you can codify it into your idea.
Yeah, I suppose that's one way you could go, and you could say that maybe it's Dhaka to some extent. It's really not about the Ani. It's not about Dine Muminis caring for the Ani. You know, it's some Isser Veheter type thing that's limited to just you, and that would explain why it's Yeridea-esque. Right, Benji? Yeah, so that's one thing to keep in mind. Notice, where does the Rambam have Hichos Tzedakah? Romy?
Matnas Aniyim, I think.
Yeah, Matnas Aniyim. Where is Matnas Aniyim? Which Sefer? Anybody know? Where is Matnas Aniyim? Someone help out Romy, or Romy, help yourself. Daniel's getting up to get his Rambam.
Kenyan.
Not Kenyan. No, but you're in Zulti's camp of guessing in the right, you know, in the place that you would think is intuitive. Ned? You don't know? Oh, Ariel.
In Zroyim.
In Zroyim, very good. In Zroyim. Why is it in Zroyim?
That's what Google told me.
What's that?
That's what Google told me.
That's what Google. Why did Google tell you that it's in Zroyim? Meaning, what explains why Google? What explains the fact that Google reported?
It's like a master kind of thing.
Yeah, because most of Matnas Aniyim are agricultural, like a Chichopeya, Shmita, Maizarani. Right, so tzedakah just gets appended or added on to the discussion of the agricultural laws of tzedakah. That's why Matnas Aniyim appears in Zroyim. Now, I want us to think, why does Matnas Aniyim appear in Zroyim? Again, it's reasonable given the agricultural framework. So I want us to think, though, why doesn't the Rambam put tzedakah in the classical sense and the more choshen mishpati, kinyin, choshenim type discussion? So I want us to think about that. But moreover, I think we should discuss or consider the relationship between tzedakah in the sense that we think of it today, giving cash or giving a check to Ani, and the more, I would say, deoraisa, or the more agricultural institutions that make up the stuff of Hilchos Zroyim, of Seder Zroyim, like a Chikha Peya Maestros, right? So I want us to think about, you know, if the Torah set up a society with all of these gifts or all of these entitlements for the Aniyim through Maestros, through like a Chikha and Peya, through Shmita, I want us to think about how that relates to our conception of tzedakah. So there's really no way to siphon off like the question of tzedakah and Baba Basra conceptually from the aspects of tzedakah through like a Chikha, Peya, Shmita, and Maaser. Okay? Do you guys agree with me? If you're trying to reconstruct the halacha's conception of tzedakah writ large. Okay? And you get a flavor of that just from the fact that the Rambam brings in Hilchos Tzedakah as an appendage to Hilchos Zroyim, where he has all of those other halachos. All right? Those are some background issues that I want us to consider as we get into our topic. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, let me just say one more thing on that last point. We know that the agricultural halachos, like at Shikha, Peya, Maaser, Ani especially, are related to what? What else do you have in Seder Zroyim or Sefer Zroyim if you're thinking about the Rambam? Ned?
Like Truma.
Yeah, Matnas Kahuna. Right, Truma, Maaser for Leviim. You have other gifts to the Kohanim that come up. So the question that we should think about is how different are the Matnos Kehuna from the Matnos Aniyim? I mean, it's true, one's given to the sect of the Kohanim and to the sect of the Levim, and one's giving to the class of people that are Aniyim. But do we view these as being different types of obligations? Right? Especially consider the fact that even Meister Shani gets swapped out with Meister Ani. Right? So I just want us to think about the relationship between these different matanos. I think in our minds, how many of you would think these things are related off the top of your head? I think there's a natural inclination to think that tzedakah to the poor is one species of things, like charity, and matnas kahuna is a different species of things. One comes out of kavod, v'kidashto, tachas avodasa b'mikdash, some of which we saw a little bit in Bavasra even. And the other, the ani discussion, comes out of a sense of graciousness and beneficence, correct? So there is reason to think that they're very different. But on the other hand, I think it would be important to see if these two things are more related than we'd initially suspect at first glance. Okay, good. Comments, Benji? I saw Benji and Ariel both wanted to say that they think Matnos Kahuna and Matnos Aniyim are related. Was that the suggestion? So Benji, you want to tell us about that, about the suggestion a little bit?
Honestly, I didn't really think it through so much. It just seems intuitive that that I guess these are like dues that have to be paid for some, like, I don't know, like public fund. One of them has to do with paying for public workers. One has to do with people that need government assistance.
Yeah, fair enough. Notice also, Benji, So we have one connection to Matnas Kahuna, Matnas Levi, etc. that Benji is pointing out. What other connection do we have in Bava Basra to contextualize the Matnos Aniyim? Comes up in Daf Ches. What connection do we have, Benji?
Is this that they're putter from digging the holes?
No.
That was the
Talmid Chachamim. I suppose it's natural to associate Talmid Chachamim with the Aniyim. What other association do you have? Ariel?
The Gemara is about the Aniyim kind of walls in the city.
We'll get to that, but that doesn't really associate it with anything. Right? What association do we have? The Rif makes this explicit in the Makoros we had for today. The Rambam picks it up, probably gets it from the Rif. What is tzedakah associated with? Come on, someone. Shmuel? Nothing? Romy?
Kofin Limno's base jar stuff?
Yes. Specifically, Lepase Ha'ir. The security costs of the city, that we could force people to pitch in for the security of the town. And in that same breath, the Gemara said that we force people to chip in for tzedakah. Right, Romy? So this is a different type of association. Right here, we're saying that, oh, maybe tzedakah is associated with the general public goods of a town. Just like the paying for the security of a town is a public good that the community could raise, so too paying for the aniyim is a type of public good. So I'm just pointing out that there are these different paradigms for framing tzedakah. So in the Gemara and Bava Basra, you might get the sense that tzedakah belongs in Hilchos Shchenim, in the same way that compelling people to pay for the public goods of police and security, paying for a food shelter or a soup kitchen, is also a public good. That's a very different way of thinking about tzedakah, a different paradigm than the idea of Matnas Kahuna. Okay? Good. So without further ado, let's get into our sugyos for today. The first sugya I put on the discussion, let me just say something about the organization. The first few sugyas that I put here are only organized this way because that's the sugyas that we already covered that broach this question of tzedakah. That's just the way I framed the Makoro sheet. So it's really just to remind you of tzedakah type things that we've encountered in Bava Basra already, to remind you and to explicate the different ways that tzedakah is significant, okay, or the different areas of halacha in which it arises. So let's start with example number one, the first discussion, and that is the discussion in the Mordechai and the Bach and Poskim in Chushan Mishpat Siman Yud Beis. Anybody remember where this came up? This came up in Runya Daf Hei, the Runya discussion about kfiya lifnim mishuras adin, compelling somebody to forfeit their halachic rights to go lifnim mishuras adin by either giving back an aveda that they're halachically entitled to keep, or by paying the workers, right? The shkulai who broke the wine barrels. Does this sound familiar? So we saw a trend in the Rishonim, starting with the Mordechai, that even if we're not generally kofe on lifnim mishuras adin, we will be kofe when, under which circumstance? Romy?
When you can afford it.
So say a little more precisely.
If he has enough money to compensate the guy.
That's one way of saying it. I want it a little more precisely, just from let's say the Mordechai and Simeon, Reishna and Zion, the way he puts it.
It's
he does say Mayichol Biado initially, but then again he has a more precise formulation later on.
If he's rich,
well, he's that's one half of it,
and the other guy's poor.
Oh, very good. Yeah, the reason I'm just making a big deal about it is because you see the later post can drop that. I'm assuming they drop it by accident, but it's actually not clear. So the Mordechai says that we could be kofeh somebody to go lifnim mishuras adin if the person who's going to become obligated is an ashir and the person who's going to be the beneficiary is an ani. The Mordechai said this to reconcile the two cases in Eilam Metzias. One case, which implies that the finder gets to keep the wallet that he finds. And the second case implies that he has to give it back, right? Even though both are lifnim mishuras adin. Just one second. Okay. Just hear someone screaming downstairs. I think it's being attended to. Do you guys hear screaming? Okay, good. It's like the tsakas ani. You know, I should leave my door open so that I could hear the screaming coming into my room. The Mordechai, to resolve those two cases, says, oh, maybe we're only kofet to do this nimi shuras adin when you have an ani against an ashir. Correct? Now, the question here is, like, what's the basis for that? Like, why should we think that lifnimi shuras adin is a function of one's financial resources? Okay. Now, if you look at the later poskim, the Bach, when he discusses this in Siman Yud Beis, which gets picked up by the Pesachei Tshuva, he drops the ani component, and he says, "Oh, the Mordechai says in Reishna and Zayin, which is literally the Mordechai we just saw, that we're kofa to do lifnim mishuras adin in my yecholas biyado lasos shehu ashir." Right. So long as the person is going to become obligated as rich, we're going to be kofa him to go lifnim mishuras adin. Now, notice how that changes the language of the Mordechai. The Mordechai seemed to say that you require both that one party be an ashir and the other be an ani. What if they're both ashirim? Right? So what do you think? Do you see that, how he changes that? And again, he says later on, the Bach says, V'chei no'agin b'chol bezdin b'Yisrael lachof la'ashir b'davar roi v'nachon b'yafav b'she'en adin kach. You know, the minhag is that every bezin will be kofa you to go lifnim mishuras adin, so long as you're an usher and you can afford it. And then he even says, even the poskim who think that you can't go lifnim mishuras adin, like the Rush and Rabbeinu Rucham that we saw, dafka for an eno usher, that they hold that way. Now, I think there's a major difference between these two formulations. The formulation of Rabbeinu Yerucham, sorry, the formulation of the Bach seems to say, look, we're going to be kofa. We want to be kofa people to go lifnim mishuras adin, but not if it's going to impose extraordinary financial burden. So long as you're wealthy enough and you're not going to take a major hit by being forced to do what's right or what's lifnim mishuras adin, we're going to be willing to be kofa you. Yes? If that's the case, then does that sugya of Runya, Daf Hei, and Eilam Metzias, and the Gemara on the end of Asochar Sapol, which we saw in Lifnim Mishuras Adin, does it shed any light on tzedakah? Rumi?
Well, I mean, in a certain sense, no, but you could also just make it a kav chomer. Like, if the giver is rich, and you know, you don't need the guy, the recipient to be poor, but kav chomer, if he is poor, then it's more like, I don't know, you could argue that.
Sure, sure. I'm saying, but the principle by itself, that let's say they're both ashirim, but will be kofa the defendant to pay. Right. So long, it's a sufficient condition for kfiya that the defendant be an ashir. Does that shed light on staka?
No.
Yeah, I think not. Right, I think it does not shed light, because what's really happening then is that this is a halacha in lifnei mishuras hadin. We really want to encourage everybody to go beyond the letter of the law. We're not going to do that. There's a limitation if it's going to impose a financial burden. Okay? Does everybody see that? Yeah? So this is really about a general theory of supererogatory conduct. Romy, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I'm not sure why, like, I would have thought to begin with that this was a din and stucca, really.
I wouldn't have, right.
So, meaning, I only read this Mordechai in the first case as maybe being able to, saying something that you could apply to stucca, even though this is actually not talking about stucca, and that, I think, is still true.
Well, let's see. Let's look at this Mordechai more carefully. I think the formulation of the Mordechai that we will only be kofa and ashir to go lefnei mishuras hadin when the plaintiff is an ani, to my mind, that suggests that this is a form of tzedakah, right? Because why else? Why does lefnei mishuras hadin depend on the adversary being in financial need? What relevance does that have to the doctrine of going beyond the call of duty, supererogatory conduct? Elamai. It seems to me that actually the Mordechai thinks that possibly there's an element of tzedaka that underlies the principle of lefnei mishuras hadin. So yeah, we're kofa to go lefnei mishuras hadin only if the plaintiff is an ani. So it's not a general theory of, oh, we generally want everybody to go beyond the letter of the law, they'll only be kofa if they could afford it. No, it sounds more like there's no general presumption that people have to go lefnei mishuras hadin. Certainly not that we're going to compel them to. But if the other party is in need, now suddenly we have a reason to be co-found supererogatory conduct. It's almost as if that tzedakah dimension makes stronger the lifnei mishuras hadin obligation. Does everybody see that? Now you're right. I think when the Bach picks up this view, he just drops the ani component. And he turns it into a general theory of when are we going to go lefnei mishuras hadin. But I think in the Mordechai, it sounds like the plaintiff being an ani is an important requisite. Everybody agree with that diak? Now, if the diak is correct, we have something extraordinary here in the Mordechai. What's extraordinary about it? Ned, what's extraordinary about the Mordechai?
I'm not sure what specifically the.
So tell us what's generally extraordinary about it. Romy?
I mean, it sounds like he's basically saying that. Well, I just think when you put the stucker thing in terms of the Mishras Adin, you're basically saying everyone's money belongs to themselves and they shouldn't really have. And actually, we have this like additional responsibility to give it to a poor person, not like. Actually, midin Torah, but lefnei mishuras hadin.
Well, this is not for tzedakah in general. This isn't a case where you find an aveda. The rules of yish are such that the finder gets to keep it. But if ani comes and claims it, lefnei mishuras hadin, you have an obligation, a coercible obligation, to give it back to him. And I'm just saying, what does his being an ani have to do with anything? Now, is anybody sympathetic to that question?
So we have the sugya introduction of ani hamahapech v'charara that talks about like another case where an ani finds a lost object, they have some like special right to it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a very nice parallel. So what's significant about that? What's significant about that case and this case? The point I want to, yeah, Zev.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the point you're going to make, but just that it's interesting. Like, usually think of tzedakah as like a separate chiyuv that you have to, or a separate activity even, but we're seeing here it's like kind of impinging on other mitzvah and other areas of halacha.
Exactly. That's exactly what I think is significant here. Generally, we think of tzedakah as an isolated chiyuv that applies in limited cases. You have to give ma'aser. Ani knocks on your door. You have to give him tzedakah. What you see here is that this idea of tzedakah actually has tentacles that extend well beyond that conception of it. And in fact, you might even say that the idea of tzedakah here has even a broader connotation of something more of like a general principle of distributive justice. You have a plaintiff and a defendant. Even though the Torah says, lo sedar p'nei dal berivo, the fact that he's an ani is a sufficient reason to trigger separate rules of adjudication, specifically kfi on lefnei mishuras hadin. Right, so that means that tzedakah somehow infiltrates its way into our general notion of like adjudicating private law disputes, right? About who owns this item that was picked up. Yes. Yeah. So if this diak is correct, it's a extraordinary extension of the mitzvah of tzedakah into the realm of adjudication, right? It's a hilchos shoftim application of tzedakah. Okay. Good. And Yitzi's right to connect us to the sugya of Aniyah Mahapech B'Charara, where arguably, according to some Rishonim, the fact that there's an ani trying to get it changes the general choshen mishpo rules of what's considered a permissible market acquisition. Okay. So that was the first thing I wanted to point us to. Let's now turn to the second case that will shed some light on tzedakah. Babasadav Zayinim Abbas. What's going on here? Kofanoso Livnos Beishar Videlos Lachatzer. And then, so the members of a chatzer have the right to force each other to build a gate, a lock, a door that would generally keep the public out, or an arsugya to protect the chatzer from hezek ri'iyah of the rabbim. And the Gemara challenges this. So what's the Gemara's challenge? Volunteer to tell us about, to read through Beishar Mal Yusahi. Ned.
Okay. Lamimra Beishar Mal Yusahi. So as if to say that having a beit shahr is a positive thing. There was this chassid who would have Eliyahu Navi come and visit him all the time. Avad beit shahr, but then this guy made a beit shahr for his chatzer, and then Eliyahu stopped showing up.
Yeah. Now, so what's the upshot? It's really remarkable. The Gemara itself doesn't tell us like what the issue was. Notice the Gemara doesn't explicate at all why Eliyahu stopped visiting this fellow. Everybody catch that? It's kind of striking when you think about reading the Gemara without Rashi and then the Gemara with Rashi. The Gemara doesn't give us an explanation at all for what the connection between the Beishar and Eliyahu ceasing to visit the homeowner was. But Ned, tell us what does Rashi say? Yeah, so what happened?
You've blocked out the cries of the aniyim. You can't hear their voices. So you've precluded them from entering the chatzar.
Yeah, there's something about building the wall or the door that blocks the aniyim from getting close enough to your house. And that makes you no longer hear the cries or the pleas or the distress of the aniyim when you live in your fortified chatzar. Okay? And the Gemara seems to say that is a bad thing. The haraya, Eliyahu Navi stopped visiting this fellow, this chassid. Now, this is not just Rashi's interpretation. Rashi does say, Lefisha mafsik ba'aniyim hatzoakim ve'in kolam nishmas. You're not going to hear the voice of the aniyim. And again, the Gemara's answer is the whole issue is about whether you're mafsik to kolam aniyim, different ways. Rabbeinu Gershom has this interpretation, right? So a permissible wall is one where the Ani's cries could still get through the barriers. So my question is, what's this about? Like, what's like, what's the problem with locking out the Ani'im? Why is that an issue?
Well, you're not going to be able to help them if they don't know that they need help.
Okay, so tell me a little more about that. Flesh that out. So where is the halachic wrongdoing?
It puts up a wall between you and the mitzvah of tzedakah.
Okay, good. So Ned has, I would say, a very nice and I would say chiyuv mitzvah based explanation for the problem here, namely, you're not going to be able to fulfill your mitzvah tzedakah if you don't hear the cries of the Ani'im. Is that right, Ned?
Well, it depends on what you think mitzvah means. But whatever, you're not going to be able to give them tzedakah.
You're not going to be able to give them tzedakah. Okay, so let me ask you, do you have a chiyuv to give them tzedakah if you don't hear? So if you buy the penthouse in a skyscraper residential building just south of Central Park. An Ani never is able to get into your building to knock on your door. Do you have a chiyuv to give that Ani? What shaychus? You write your check every year out to all the tzedakah institutions that you support. So why cares that the Ani can't knock on your door? Let's take Ned, are you talking or you're muted? No, you're not muted.
No, I'm muted. Okay. No, I mean, yeah, okay. So this is a raya that Aniyim have. The expectation is that you should be giving any Ani stuff if they have need.
What do you mean? I'm not able to give tzedakah to the Ani'im who live in Eretz Yisrael because I live in America. Take Rabbi Weider's example from his Sichas Musar, right? So you move to Rinat and there's no Ani'im in, apparently, there's no Ani'im in Bergen County. So, no one to give tzedakah to locally. So is that a problem according to this Gemara?
Meaning if they don't exist?
If they don't exist in your vicinity, right? I mean, let's say you're writing your check out to tzedakah every year, right? Who cares whether they, who cares whether the Ani'im, you're not able to hear the tzakas on the Ani'im? I'll make my point directly. My point is that, Ned, you're saying that this Gemara is about being mevatel, the mitzvah, or the chiyuv tzedakah, right? Somehow, it's like you're saying this guy is trying to avoid his or defeat his tzedakah obligation. Is that your reading?
Yeah, I'm trying, I don't know, but...
Okay, he's just a mimela, he is.
Yeah.
Okay. So Ned's giving us a plausible reading. I don't deny that it's a plausible reading. You know, he's saying maybe the chiyuv tzedakah only kicks in when an ani is poshet yad, and if you never have that opportunity, then you're somehow defeating the mitzvah tzedakah. Do you guys agree with Ned's reading?
Well, I don't think I'm that much of a minimalist. Meaning that could be one aspect, at the very least.
Right. So you're defeating one aspect of the mitzvah tzedakah.
Yeah.
That's very possible. I want to push back, not to say that Ned's reading is wrong, but I want to push back on Ned's reading for two reasons. Number one, I think there's an argument to be made that maybe if you never encounter an Ani, there's no chiyuv to give that Ani. Right? I'm sure there are plenty of Ani'im that you've never encountered. It's not obvious that you have a chiyuv to give the Ani that you never met. Right? Also, it's very plausible that you're giving tzedakah other ways. Like, why can't I lock myself in my house? I write a check out to the tzedakah organizations that distribute tzedakah on my behalf. And then why do I need to meet the Ani who's walking down the street? Right? Like, why can't I fulfill my chiyuv tzedakah in these other ways? You guys agree with me?
Well, there's also the more personal aspect of tzedakah. Halacha demands that people have certain emotions or attitudes when they give tzedakah that might not be possible.
Okay, but maybe I could have the attitude of graciously giving tzedakah when I write the check out to the tzedakah organization. And I'm very happy to write the check. Romy?
Well, maybe it's just about the you have to be able to hear them, meaning you're not obligated to give everyone, but you're right. Like you said, like, you know, if you don't see them, maybe you're a putter, but you're not allowed to make sure you don't see them.
And why is that?
And I don't know, my gut, that's not fully formulated. My gut is that you need to be able to make the choice to kind of consider them, hear them out. And then, you know, you make a choice or something. I mean, I guess maybe that's assuming you give a certain amount of stuck in general or whatever. Yeah.
So let me flesh out either what Romy is saying or maybe a small variation off what Romy is saying. To me, it seems that there's a way. I was like, Josh, just switch devices. Josh, you switched devices on us?
Yes.
There we go. We got him. Josh is probably walking to the streets now to find Aniyim to get stuck at here.
Yeah, I got to be mobile.
There you go. As long as it's not to wait in line for the basketball game.
Fast Michelle on LOL.
There we go. I think there's a way of interpreting this Gemara that it's actually not about the mitzvah of tzedakah in terms of the chiyuv to give or the obligation to give, etc. But actually, it's about the way the society is supposed to look, where you don't have a strong division between the aniyim and the ashirim. So it's actually not as Ned was suggesting, that this is to make sure that I'm Yotzei Zayin, that I fulfill my chiyuv tzedakah in the right way whenever there's an ani nearby. But the halacha thinks there's actually a separate issue with creating a chatzer or a mavoi or a bayis in a way where you are, I want to say, immune, or you are totally protected from hearing the tzakas aniyim. Does anybody see that suggestion? Now, whether that's somehow related to the mitzvah of tzedakah or totally distinct from the mitzvah of tzedakah, I think is an open question. Meaning, I think it's totally okay to say this is not about motivating you to give tzedakah per se. It's not about giving the ani an opportunity to get tzedakah from you per se. It's actually just about the way the halacha considers these barriers between different classes, that it's bad for a society between different economic classes, that there be a society that's just totally insulated from the tzakas aniyim. Thoughts on this? My motivation for saying this is my, you know, responses to Ned. And second of all, because there's no notion of tzedakah in these Rishonim. Like, the Rishonim don't say, oh, you're going to lose out on your mitzvah tzedakah in any way. They say that badness consists in blocking out the tzakas aniyim. Anybody have a thought on my reading?
What about all of the, like, the Gemara then proceeds to explain which source of gates are.
Yeah, but all those types of gates are just, as Rashi says, and then Rabbeinu Gershom say, those are just about whether it's mafsik the kolani, whether he could get in close enough. Right? Yachal ha'ani likanes besocha mechitza speshar. Right, so Ned, a lot of Rishonim just read those things as shiurim and whether the cry of the ani will get through. Yeah? Ned? Okay. Anybody have thoughts on this? I think it's a nice alternative reading. Let's take Shmuel and then Zev.
I mean, I think the reading is compelling. Is there something to be said about like the wording of like tzakas and like just this very visceral? I think the way Ned read it sort of reads better with the that sort of the wording of the Gemara, like we want to hear them, we want to sort of invoke some sort of emotion more so than just like a commentary on dividing classes.
Well, I agree that evoking the emotion might be important because. You might say it's important for a person to be familiar with like a tzakas ha'ani, right? Just part of being a human being is to understand the plights of other people in society, something like that, without it being instrumental for the chiyuv tzedakah. That's really my main point. Right. So whether it's about, you know, something more broadly about what the Hilchos Shcheinim should look like, or whether it's like a Hilchos Deos issue about personally about what your dispositions and midos are, my point is that it's not instrumental. It's not necessarily instrumental for Hilchos Matnas Aniyim. Now,
yeah, I mean, I definitely hear it. I think it go both ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I should say a little more. It may be the case that Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, Hilchos Tzedakah, ends up being instrumental to saying something like I'm saying. Or like we'll see in some Rishonim explicitly, oh, Tzedakah is to cultivate like the Mida beneficence. And right, you might even say something like that. But my point is that there's no reason to say, based off this Gemara, that it's all a Hechetimtzi to be Mekayim more of Mitzvah Tzedakah. Right, just a way of being of fulfilling more tzedakah. Good. Zav, you have a hand? You had a hand?
Yeah. No, never mind. Brilliant.
Sure.
Yeah.
Great. Ned, you hear my reading?
I hear it. I just don't want to bifurcate the two.
You don't want to bifurcate which two?
I don't want to say that there's value in just having a sense of people's suffering and then that not being tied to any obligation to give.
Why do you want to tie it to the mitzvah of tzedakah?
Like, what good is that sympathy? I don't know, it just doesn't seem to.
You're saying, well, let's talk more about this, but you might say that, let's say somebody has exhausted their chiyuv tzedakah, Ned. Here's an interesting nafkamina. Somebody has given all the tzedakah they could give. And if they were to give any more, then they would already be putting themselves into a position of financial precariousness. And so halachically, they've exhausted their chiyuv tzedakah. The question then is there still a maila in not having this beis shaar to be mafsik between the kol aniyim? Ned?
You can afford a beis shaar, you're not in that position.
Oh, come on.
All right. Yeah, no, I hear the nafkamina. It's just not this case. Yeah.
Okay, so we should think more about this. Let me say one more piece on this Gemara here that we saw in Zayin and Beis. The Meiri comments here. Beis shaar zeh sha'amru b'mishnah, shebnei achatzer kofen ba zeh zeh, dafka b'she'en ba nidnud avera, klal. Hayesh ba nidnud avera, Vehusha asuya biderach shaha aniyim ein yecholim likanes lahedya, bitzoakim mibachutz ve ein kola nishma mipnei sha beishar mafzik es kolo ein kofin zeza. Now I think this Meiri is actually pashut, but there are two things that I want to just say about it, even though I don't think anything here is mechudash, but I want to explicate two components of it. Number one is his characterization of nidnud avera. So he thinks that when you build a wall that keeps out the tzakas aniyim, there's a nidnud avera there. It means there's an element or a dimension of an avera. Anybody know what nidnud means? No?
What?
So,
no, yeah.
What did you say, Ned?
I said it's like my word.
Why is it your word? Because Ned?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Like wandering.
Yeah, so what does it? What does it have to do with, you know, what does that have to do in context here?
It's almost like, I don't know, I would read it like almost like a hero avera, maybe.
And that's like, actually, you know, I cracked open my Jastro again. And you know what? It means right. No, I'm just kidding. Joke. Nidnud avera comes from like the word of movement, like nava nud, yabaret, or nad nade is to move back and forth. Like in modern Hebrew, nadnate is like a seesaw. Ooh, look, we're getting Josh Brofman joining us. Hey, Josh. Hey, Josh Brofman. Looks like Josh is like flying a helicopter somewhere. Just from like the... No. Why does nidnud connote something bad? Because when you disapprove of something, you nod your head. So Jastro, it has the notion of wrongdoing, like the type of thing that invokes nodding, like shaking your head at somebody. It's pretty good, no? Great. So he says, so something that's be like frowned upon. So number one is that he characterizes as nidnud avera. Now, my question is, That's very interesting. So it's not just like in the Gemara, you might get a sense that it's just an aspect. It's a lack of midas chasidus. Like Eliyahu Hanavi stopped visiting this guy because he wasn't living up to his pious standard. And then Meiri takes it a little further and says, oh, there's actually an aspect of wrongdoing here, right? A little bit of an avera. You guys agree with that, Diak? Yeah. Now I'm wondering if this formulation helps us shed light on my disagreement with Ned. Like, would you characterize Ned's view as just, it's like a nidnud avera? There's like an aspect of an avera in putting yourself in a position where you're not going to be mekayim, you don't have a chiyuv tzedakah? I'm not sure. So I want to think about that. The second point I want to make here, which I think is obvious, is that the Gemara is saying implicitly, it's not explicated by the other Rishonim, and it's actually not so clear in the Gemara. Why does the Gemara introduce this conversation? What did the Mishnah say? Kofin zezeh livnos beishar videlas, correct? Now the Gemara says, wait a second, lemeimra, that beishar is a mal yusa, you're saying a beishar is a good thing? What about this story of the chassid? So you could say the Gemara is just saying, wait a second, it's a bad thing. Why is the Mishnah endorsing it? The Meiri goes further and says, actually, the legal right of the b'nei ha-chatzer to be kofin zezeh for public goods is defeated when the public goods are going to lock out the tzakas ha'ani. So everybody see that? So actually, the law of the Mishnah of Kofin Zez, I live in this Beishar V'delas V'choma, does not apply if it's going to be constructed in a way that harms the aniyim. Ha'yeshba nidno davera, that's done in this way, etc. Ein Kofin Zez, they don't have the power to compel each other to construct these public goods. Why is that important? So I think this is a similar theme to the first example we looked at today, the Lefnim Mishuras Adin discussion. We've been talking about the scope of these dinim of tzedakah, right, or the needs of the aniyim. In the first example, we saw that tzedakah infiltrates the laws of Hilchos Shoftim. We're going to suddenly coerce on Lefnim Mishuras Adin if the plaintiff is an ani. And here we see that Hilchos Tzedakah could actually defeat the Hilchos Shchenim rights of the B'nai HaChatzer. Right, so the B'nai HaChatzer have a power to be Kofez as I live in the space Arvidelas, but that's going to be defeated if there's an El Nidnu Navera blocking out the Tzakas Ani. Does anybody see that? When you read the Gemara, did you think the Meiri's reading was Pasha? That's obvious that this issue would defeat the Kofin Zez power? Or was it saying there's still a Kofin Zez power, but you know, don't think it's a Mal Yusa? Anybody have a view on this? What was your first impression when you read the Gemara? Romy?
I mean, the language of Mal Yusa just makes it sound like better and worse. So
that's yeah. Kind of what I assume. It's not. It didn't sound like the Meiri's reading, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I think on the other hand, you might say, well, why? You know, you might say it's a bit of a non sequitur for the Gemara to go from this din in the Mishnah to asking the case of Eliyahu, because nothing in the Mishnah that implies it's a good thing. Mishnah just saying, right? It's a legal hilchos shchenim, right?
Right. I guess to me it was just like, you know, in the Mishnah said then like, oh, we have a problem, and then you kind of resolve it, and it would have been like, okay, yeah, doing it another way. I guess yeah, maybe it implies doing it another way would have been usher.
Yeah. Would not just that it would have been usher. It would have been usher in a way that defeats the Hilchos Shchenim power of each member of the Chatzer to compel the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw Benji had a hand that went up and then went down.
Yeah, I was mostly just testing the hand raising shortcut thing, but I read it like Meiri, meaning the whole point of being kofin each other is only for like public goods. If you say that this is a public bad, then obviously you can't be kofing each other to build it.
Oh, but it's still a public good vis-a-vis the members of the B'nai HaChatzer, arguably. It's a public bad vis-a-vis the Aniyim. No? Unless you want to say that because it's a Nidnud Avera, it's no longer considered a public good for the B'nai HaChatzer.
Right. I think you have to say the Nidnud Avera, then especially meaning within the context of the Gemara, like with Rashi saying that you know, Eliyahu coming to the town is definitely a good thing. So to say that, meaning that's not like something bad for Eliyahu, that was bad for everyone.
Wait a second, Benji. One second here. Are you saying that the bad is that Eliyahu HaNavi is no longer coming? Are you saying that the bad is the thing that explains why Eliyahu HaNavi didn't come, meaning blocking out the tzakas ani?
Oh, interesting. I mean, right. So I thought initially that the issue was the fact that Eliyahu was not going to be there. That's why it was bad.
Ooh. I don't know.
You're saying that that's just a siman that like bad things are happening.
Well, let's see. To my mind, the nidnun aveira is that the aniyim are tzoakim mibachutz and you're not hearing their voice.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely what the Meiri is saying. I'm saying just from when I initially read
from the sugya itself.
Right.
Interesting. So I feel like Benji, you're shtickle in, you know, Eitan Northman's camp about the Kibud Av Eim. You know, I'm gonna do the Kibud Av Eim to make sure that Eliyahu HaNavi comes to visit. No.
Meaning there's definitely what to be said in this Eitan Northman camp. I don't know if I fully fall into it, but I think meaning there's definitely kernels of truth to it.
Yeah, fair enough. That's an interesting way of reading the Gemara. Did anybody else read the Gemara Benji's way? Is that a curiosity that the badness lies in Eliyahu HaNavi not coming? I see Kobe is saying no. All right. Kobe, aren't you Benji's roommate? But it seems like you guys are elsewhere today.
Sometimes we're not in the same place. Not very often, but sometimes.
Happens every now and then. All right. So I want to add to this discussion the Rambam and Hilchos Yom Tov Perek Vav Halacha Yud Zayin. Actually, Zecharia mentioned this on the Shir WhatsApp when we did this initially. The discussion of Simchas HaRegel, Rambam talks about the mitzvah of Chayv Adam Lios Behen Sameach V'Tov Lev, Hu Bana V'Ishto V'Nei Beso, Chol Anilvim Alav, V'Samachta B'Chagecha. Even though that in the Torah refers to Karban Shlomim, the Rambam says, Yesh B'Chlal Osa Simcha L'Smoach Hu Bana V'Nei Beso Kol Echa V'Echad K'Roi Lo. Then in Hichos Yom Tov Perek Vav Halacha Yud Ches, the next halacha, Rambam gives a few examples. You know, he talks about Simcha for all the different members here. One second. Okay, yeah, the Rambam mentions all these different aspects. And he says, Uchshu ochel v'shosa chayiv lahachil lager liyosem l'almana im sh'ar ha'aniyim ha'umlalim. Haval misha noel delosos chatzero v'ochel v'shosa hu vana v'ishto V'eino machil mashkel aniyim hulamare nefesh einzu simchas mitzvah ala simchas kreso. Are you all familiar with this Rambam? It's a good Rambam to familiarize yourself with. So what's so Zecharia pointed this out when we read the Sugyan Dav Zayin because it talks about same phrase. I mean, maybe even the Rambam is borrowing from this Gemara. Misha noel delosos chatzero. Now, what's the Rambam characterizing here in Hilchos Yom Tov? What's he characterizing here? Which mitzvah are we dealing in? Mitzvah tzedakah? Zev?
Simchas Yom Tov?
Yeah, mitzvah Simchas Yom Tov. And the Rambam seems to say that somebody who closes off their door to the aniyim is not celebrating Simchas Yom Tov in the proper way, right? So Ned, just to get back to your point, I'd want to think a little more if the Rambam's actually drawing from our Gemara. We should look carefully in the Nosei Kelim and the Mefarshim on the Rambam to see where they think he's pulling this from. But what's fascinating to my mind is that this is not about Hilchos Tzedakah narrowly construed. It's about a person who celebrates Yontif with his door shut is not properly celebrating Yontif. And he's not properly being Mekayim Simchas Yom Tov. And to my mind, that speaks to two things. Number one, it speaks to the general theme that we've been seeing about aspects of the Chiyuv to the Aniyim spilling or infiltrating beyond narrow Hilchos Tzedakah. Now we're already in Hilchos Yom Tov. right? In the Meiri, we were in Hilchos Shechinim, and in the Mordechai, we were in Hilchos Shoftim. Right, so here's an aspect that spills into Hilchos Yom Tov. And number two, I think this reinforces my reading, possibly against Ned's reading. The Rambam's point here seems to be that, like, setting up these types of divisions, the class divisions, is somehow problematic for Simchas Yom Tov. Not just that you're not mikayim the mitzvah stuck on the right way. You guys agree with that reading? Zev, you agree with that reading?
Why can't you say that it's to Ned's point as well, that the fact that you're sort of making this quote unquote avera, or however Ned wanted to phrase it.
What's the avera? What's the avera?
So maybe I'm misconstruing that, but so maybe the fact that you are, to go back to how I wrote down that, actively like blocking the Aniyim's cries, maybe that's the problem in Simchas Yom Tov. I don't see why one would be a better read of the Rambam than the other.
Say it again, Shmuel. Say a little more.
Why can't we say that Ned's understanding of like actively blocking them out is also a problem in Simchas Yom Tov? I don't see like it's against Ned. I could see it going both ways again.
Well, but the difference between me and Ned is not about whether you're actively blocking them out. I thought the difference is that for Ned, it's about defeating your tzedakah obligation. My dad was the problem with blocking them.
Why can't that be a problem in Simchas Yom Tov as well?
Defeating your tzedakah obligation?
Yeah, like that. I don't know. Problematic. Simchas Yom Tov is about tzedakah.
That's a big chiddush. Yeah. That's a big chiddush. You're saying that Simchas Yom Tov is about tzedakah now? Well, see, I'm saying it's not. I'm saying Simchas Yom Tov.
So saying about class divisions is not a big chiddush?
Well, it depends on your political views, I guess. Now, my point is just that we think that there's something of like a tzibur dikas celebration, right? We celebrate Simchas Yom Tov as a kehila. Even in Purim, we say part of the celebration was Mishloach Manos Yisroei Matanos Levyonim. Klal Yisrael was celebrating, and Klal Yisrael celebrates where we celebrate without attention to the economic or financial security of different members of Klal Yisrael. No? So to my mind, that is built into the notion of celebrating Yontif as a tzibur.
We're taking away one of our core values of core tenets of Judaism, tzedakah. That's
not one of the five Torahs.
That should play into all our Yom Tovim. So maybe the fact that we've taken that away from ourselves is also a downgrade in Simchas Yom Tov. Like, it's maybe a little bit more of a stretch, but I don't think it's like a knockout to Ned's reading.
Yeah, I hear that. Ned, you have thoughts on this? You agree with Amar Shmuel?
I don't want to take credit for the reading. I don't think I... It's not the...
You're not committed to the reading.
No, it's not my reading. It's just a reading.
It was just a reading. Oh, so even Ned's disassociating himself from the reading even. Any other thoughts on this Rambam, how it fits into the... I do want to point out that the Rambam's rationale here, Ainzu Simchas Mitzvah, the Simchas Kreso, right? It's not a Simcha of a Mitzvah, it's just hedonism. To my mind, that's clear that this is not about Bittul Mitzvah Tzedakah, Shmuel. The Rambam's really saying that if you celebrate in this way, it's clear that you're just celebrating hedonistically because you enjoy wine and you enjoy food. Whereas, like, if you truly appreciated Yontif, you'd be celebrating with all members of the kahal. That's so. I think to read in Bittul Mitzvah Tzedakah here would be a bit of a stretch, in my mind. Yeah. Thoughts on this? And you could say the Rambam reads our Gemara in that light. That's, you know, there are nafkemina for many areas of halacha, where someone who's Noel Delosos Beso is doing a halachic wrong beyond the Bittul Mitzvah Tzedakah component. But we could talk more about that. All right, thoughts before we move on? Ariel, was that a hand? No? Looks like he moved into a quieter section of the Beis Medrash.
Rublowski was starting his Chabura in my seat, so I needed to find another place.
Much quieter now. Yeah. Kind of nice. I guess everyone went to Shear also. All right, so let's look at the next section that I wanted to bring up for discussion. The Marma Basra Chesamid Aleph. So now we're a little closer to where we're at for we're holding in our sugya. The Gemara Babasa Daf Ches brought up this Braisa Agav Urcha along the road of its along the path of its discussion, and it introduced aspects of tzedakah to aniyim, along with the other social obligations, public good obligations, like supporting the Pasei Ha'ir. So let's start with this Braisa over here on Daf Ches Amid Aleph. Let's take a volunteer. Shmuel, you want to read this Gemara for us?
I haven't gotten there yet.
So we could pass it off to somebody who prepared it. Who prepared this Gemara? Say, Ariel, you want to take it for us?
Sure. Hatanya Shloshim Yom Latamchoy, Shlosha Chadashim Lakupa, Shisha Laksot, Tisha Lakvura, Shnemas Alafase Eir.
Yeah. So what does this mean?
So it's basically given the amount of time you have to be residing in the city to be chayev to participate in that fund. So for the tamchoy, exactly. It's 30 days, 3 months for the kupa, 6 months, the chsod, I think it's for the clothing for the aniyim, as Rashi states, and then 9 months for burial and shnemasa, the fase year.
Great. Excellent. So I want to make two general diukim in this Gemara before we talk about specifically the kupa and the tamchoy distinction. The first diuk is notice the association. We have four things that are tzedakah related, tamchoy, kupa, ksus, and kvura. As Ariel pointed out very nicely, all of those are tzedakah related. Tamchoy is what, Ariel? Rashi tells us.
Machol aniyim.
Yeah, which is what?
Food for the aniyim to eat.
Good. Kupa?
I guess tzedakah, but I guess just money for them to live off of.
Yeah, we'll see a machloka. That's exactly what it means. The Rambam and the Riff have different gears on the Gemara, but exactly. Generally speaking, kupa is money for them to live off of. Tamchoy is like a soup kitchen by giving them food to survive on. And what's ksus?
It's their like clothing.
Yeah, luxus or lechasos on your clothing for them to wear, right? And what's kvura?
Money to pay for their burial.
Yeah, money to pay for the burial of an ani. So those four things, the first four things in the Braisa are all about provisions for poor people. What's the last thing in the Braisa?
I think it's just like the general maintenance of a community.
Security. I think it's security. It's something to fortify the wall of the town. Now the Riff, what's that, Ariel?
Oh, so it wouldn't be considered tzedakah in that case.
Yeah, it's not staka. Pase year is clearly not staka. That's for sure. So the Riff has a diuk from this association. Let's, he cites the Braisa. There's a small girsa change. We'll deal with that about kupa, inverting the kupa and the tamchoy. We'll get to that soon. But what does the Riff add to this discussion, Ariel?
That they're chiyuvim and that you can force somebody to pay them.
Yeah. So just read it inside. Shamina mina.
So he's using Faseir as the, I guess, archetype, and then everything else is following that system to say that you're forced to pay it.
Exactly. The key argument here is that Dumya de Pasei Ha'ir, in the same way that we know that a town could force its constituents to pay for security on the walls, etc., so too, these tzedakah things could be compelled bal korcha of the participants. So this, as I mentioned, at the outset of today's discussion, this associates tzedakah with the security provisions of a town, which to my mind sounds like we're firmly entrenched here in Hilchos Shechinim. Right? What are the public goods that a town could compel people to give towards, to contribute towards? Pasei Ha'ir, security, walls, doors, and these provisions for the aniyim. Yes? Okay, so we want to bear that in mind. That's point number one. And a very interesting chiddush that it's coercible. So we have two chiddushim, right? Number one, the conceptual association point that we're in Hilchos Shechinim land, that meaning the laws of a society's power to raise money for its public goods, its public provisions. And number two, that because these tzedakah provisions fall under that description, they're legally coercible. Yes? Everybody with me? That comes straight out of the Riff. Point number two I want to make in this Gemara taking those 2 points in the riff as just two general points in the, under the first issue. So the second issue I want to raise in this Gemara is notice the wide range of tzedakah provisions itself, not the association between tzedakah and pasayir, but internally within tzedakah. What do we have here? Four different dimensions of tzedakah: kupa, tamchoi, ksus, and kvura. Now, just to ask you guys, are these obvious? Like, are these obvious dimensions of tzedakah? Not obvious? Ariel?
I guess an initial reaction I had when reading the Gemara is that l'sot is not something that I would think of as a separate fund. Like, I would understand the kupa, and then maybe just that's included in it, but the fact that it notes it separately.
Okay. Romy?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think you could just, like, you could say, yeah, those aren't like tzedakah, and then you actually don't have to read them like tzedakah. You could just say they're more public goods related, in which case you're obligated mitzad public goods. And if it's more intuitive to you that they are tzedakah, then you read them mitzad tzedakah. Like, it might be true they're not so clear in the category of tzedakah, but then there's included in a different category they're obligated to pay for.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, except that I would just say, so Romy's making an excellent point. Romy's saying maybe the first point offsets the second point. The first point is to show the association to public goods. So maybe it's counterintuitive to say that kvura, burying an ani, the expenses of burying an ani, is tzedakah strictly construed. But so it's not tzedakah, it's part of the public goods of a town. We don't want bodies strewn all over the street, so we give we fund burial spots for poor people. Right, Romy?
Yeah, I guess the further you could take that further, which maybe is what you were trying to say, and then say all these things are just kind of public good things, like that kind of range on the spectrum from totally security issue to tzedakah, and some things in between that kind of fall somewhere in the middle of like kind of relating to tzedakah, but also kind of just being public good.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, let me say a little more, even just to, you know, if anybody wants to think more crisply about public good, tzedakah as a public good. So what do we mean by tzedakah as a public good? And then I'll take the hands. So one could argue and say, look, we should, here's a classic argument. One could argue and say we should raise money for soup kitchens and to shelter the poor and to even give them some disposable income so that they could go and buy clothing from Century 21. Why? Because that's a whole lot cheaper than having to let all these poor people roam around the city and break into our homes to steal food and clothing, and then having to pay to lock them up in jail. So as a public good, in the same way that it's cheaper to pay for a wall than to be conquered by an aggressive neighboring territory, neighboring army, it's cheaper to pay off the aniyim, give them their basic needs so that everybody else could be happy and not have the aniyim steal from them. Everybody see how that's it's a very just simple way of thinking about tzedakah as a public good. It's not about the entitlement of the ani. It's not about the zchus of the ani. It's not about the dignity of the ani in any way. It's really just a cost analysis about how to make the city as clean and nice as possible. Or you could think about it another way, right? The city will look dirty if you have people who are poorly dressed on the roads. People are afraid to take the subway when you have homeless people living in the subway cars. So it's cheaper, it's overall better for the city to just fund homeless shelters than to scare everybody off from taking public transportation. Does everybody see that? That would be like the simplest way of just construing tzedakah as a public good. Yeah? Okay. Coming back to this discussion, putting aside Romy's point that maybe the kfura and the ksus are all part of the pasayir public good component. So putting that aside, I think it's just, if it's about tzedakah strictly construed, then we have a pretty broad range of things that are covered by tzedakah, right? Burying the ani after death, right? So that would mean that there's like an aspect of tzedakah. Romy's whole point is that, well, it's a, is there such a thing as tzedakah after the person is deceased? It's a little strange. Maybe it's a public good type thing. Right, Romy? Yeah. But if we don't go in that direction and we say that this is narrowly speaking a tzedakah obligation, then it's striking that stucca extends to these types of things. Okay. Anybody have thoughts on that? Benji.
Yeah, when it comes to like fura, like we have the concept of the egel rufa, we know that there's always a chiv on the B'nai Ha'ir to do fura in a case where like no one else is doing fura. So I thought that what all this was saying was the time frame that is required for one to live in a city in order for them to be like part of the B'nai Ha'ir from that perspective. Like, I don't know if it's necessarily like a tzedakah component.
I mean, you're saying with Romy that these provisions are just chiyuvei ha'ir more generally, or public goods of the city?
Yeah, I would say more chiyuvei ha'ir, like Romy.
Not like a personal tzedakah obligation. So you want to say that when I have a chiyuvei tzedakah, it doesn't extend to ksus and kvura. Is that you want to say, Benji?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Okay, so I think it's an open question. I think it depends on the issue just discussed, but I do want to say that if we don't lean in for the public, you know, kahal type public goods provision theory, then it's striking at least that kvura and ksus are part of the mitzvah of tzedakah. We'll see other discussions along these lines later on, actually. De machsura washer yechzarlo, as characterizations of the ani's needs, even if he needs a wife, getting him a wife. Somebody, I was speaking to somebody the other day, he says he doesn't have money to date. He can't pay for the gas and things like that. So you say, okay, but he's, you know, he's got clothes, he's got food. So you could argue as part of chiv tzedakah to help somebody get access to a car so that they could start dating. Right, so we'll see. It's a very important question. What's included under this mitzvah of tzedakah? Arguably, our Gemara might be taking a stance on it. Now, let me just say a little more here. Our girsa in the Gemara is that if you're in a town for 30 days, you're chayiv in the tamchoy. If you're there for 3 months, you're chayiv in the kupa. Okay. Tamchoy on Rashi's reading seems to be food for the aniyim, so like a soup kitchen. The kupa is the more robust tzedakah fund. There's a trespasser in my office. I'm not sure what to do about this. Okay. Give me 1 second. Baby's going to say hi to everybody. Want to say hi very quickly? Say hi. Want to wave to everybody? Want to wave? Like that? Yeah? Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to give me 30 seconds to deposit her downstairs.
Ariel, you have a hello, Ariel?
Should have set up a ballot in Beit Shah. Lishmoa b'chiyo shel tinok.
Yitzi, you didn't want to go to share in person?
Were you guys just sitting here quietly? Okay, good. A little worried.
Benji was monitoring the conversation. He was.
Who was?
Benji.
Good. Good job, Benji. So our girsa is that 30 days is sufficient to obligate you in the tamchoy. 3 months is sufficient to obligate you in the kupa. Now, we should give some thought about why these different obligations kick in at different points. Does anybody have a theory for that? Like, why should the ksus or kvura take longer to become obligated in than the other things? Like, what would be the basis for that? So we should give some thought to that, but today, let me just make the smaller point that the Rambam has the inverted girsa. This is based off the girsa of the Rif, which you could see over here. The Rif's girsa is lamid yom lekupa gimel chadashim l'tamchoy, which means that you're obligated first in a kupa and only later in a tamchoy. Does everybody see that? So that's a little significant just in distinguishing between these two entities. Like, what are they exactly and which is considered to be more important? the Rambam has the assumption and the Rif has the assumption that the more basic obligation is going to kick in first, whereas the less basic, more extravagant is going to kick in later. So you can see here, the Rambam also has this. And Manos Aniyim Tes Yud Beis, Misha Yasha B'Medina Shloshim Yom, Kofen Oso Litein Tzedaka L'Kupa Im B'nei HaMedina. So 30 days, you are obligated in the Kupa. 3 months, Yasha Shem Shlosha Chadashim, Kofen Oso Litein HaTamchoi. Okay. Let me just also make a small other diuk here. In Hilchos Manos Aniyim Tes Yud Beis, same halacha, notice that the Rambam adds a word when he characterizes the other two chiyuvim. That's not in the Gemara. Yashav sham shisha chadashim kofenos olitein tzedaka b'ksus shemachasim ba anyei ha'ir. Yashav sham tish chadashim kofenos olitein tzedaka l'kvura shekovrim ba asaniyim. V'osnam kol sarche kvura. So maybe I shouldn't make too much of a fuss about this, but notice, just getting back to Romy's point, the Rambam characterizes these as tzedaka, which you might say, you know, is to contrast them with a type of just pure public goods type thing. Now, it's fine. You could say the word tzedaka is broad enough to include those types of public good provisions also. Rami, you could respond that way. But we're in Hilchos Manos Aniyim here in the Rambam, right? Which is, again, you could just say it's a classification question. You know, the Rambam chose not to put in Hilchos Shchenim. Maybe it could have gone either way. But just, I think that extra word tzedakah might push us a little more into like the sui generis or the internal categories of Hilchos Tzedakah. Romy, would you agree with that, Diak? Yeah. Again, it's a defeasible Diak. You could go the other way. So, but you like it.
I mean, it's actually, it's pretty compelling. Like, he didn't have to do it. Like, it's always more obvious to just quote the Gemara straight up. So
yeah,
adding anything seems like it's hard to characterize adding anything as a mistake or like, yeah, just kind of like,
great. Yeah, I agree with that. Now the Marik in Siman Yud Zayin, very important Shiva, the Marik, he points out that, and this gets paskened in the Shulchan Aruch, that when you have a new city that's starting off, they could compel each other to chip in for the Kupa and the Tamchui and the Ksus and all that right away. Like, this Gemara is really about, you have an established city. The city has all these public provisions. And the question is, when does a new resident become obligated to chip in into all of these different things? Now, again, it's still a chiddush that his chiyuvim should kick in at different points. We have to explain that. But the Marik's position here is that if it's a new city, these obligations are triggered right away because every city has to have these things right away, right? He says, these shirim are only for somebody who's kind of visiting and he overstays his his traveler's visa. Then, like, he becomes a resident for these different things at different times. We should keep our eyes open. I didn't add this to the source sheet yet. Is your obligation to kick in somehow coterminous with your entitlement to benefit from these things? So is the idea that if you're in town for 8 months, you're not entitled to get ksus from the town, but if you're there for 9 months, then you are entitled, and that's why you're... If that's true, then you get a very interesting type of argument that you're only obligated to chip in if you're a potential beneficiary as well. So it's, bear that in the back of your mind when you think about these different shirim. In any event, the important part of this Marik is that he emphasizes the different girsos. The standard girsa and argamar that we have for Rashi is that you're obligated for a tamchui at 30 days and a kupa at 3 months. The Rif and the Rambam have it backwards. He points out there are different girsos in the Gemara here. So he says it's really just a girsa issue. But what is the machlokas and the girsos about? So he says this. He says, the girsa that we have is that a tamchoy obligation comes first, before kupa, mipnei shehu matzoy bibayis shel adam. So I think the idea here is that food is readily available in people's homes. So your obligation to participate in the soup kitchen is prior to your obligation to contribute your earnings and your wealth towards tzedakah. Does everybody see that? It's about how readily available the thing you're contributing is. That's this view. That's the Shulchan Aruch's view. That's the Chachmei Ashkenaz's view. But the Rambam's view, he says, arises from the following. He says, the Rambam holds that a kupa is more basic because that's a davar katsuv, kifi ha-mamon asher tasig kol echad ve-echad, ha-ashir yarbe ve-hadal yamit, u-mishum kach mischaye behem miyad, achar shloshim yom. What I think he's trying to say here is that the most basic tzedakah obligation is to contribute a percentage of your earnings or your wealth, whatever the town deems as your obligation. So this is your basic obligation, the kupa. And that's like the most fundamental tzedakah requirement. That's determined by your monetary wealth and by the needs of the aniyim. The tamchui is not a davar katsuv. That's more volitional, govin meis kol ish asher yidvenu libo. You know, they'd go around and they'd say, look, now that we took care of everyone's basic necessities through the tax of the kupa, which is designed to figure out the needs of the aniyim, to figure out the means of the ashirim, now we have a tamchoy, which is actually of leftover food from Shabbos. Come, give it to the aniyim. You want to give a little extra, put it into the tamchoy. So the Rambam sees these institutions as being differentiated by like the most basic requisite stuff versus the extra donations that people want to give on top of that. Everybody good with that distinction? Yeah, for the kupa and tamchoy, good. And then again, he says explicitly, he says the tamchoy was not nitkan, ela kadei sheyia lehem laniyim mizonos yoser berevach. Right, the tamchoy was there to, you know, give the aniyim fancier meals, to give them more of a buffer, right? Extra food in their pantry. Aval milvad mibilado yesh lehem hasipuk bitzimtzim al yidei gibui akupa. So the picture you get from the Ma'arik's characterization of the Rambam is that there was the kupa, which provided the basic needs of the aniyim. Right, the Bezdin did some assessment. What did the aniyim need? Let's say basic food for the day, basic food for the week. That was imposed on all the ashirim as an obligation in accordance with their need, with their means. Yes? That's why that's the most basic level of tzedakah. Then there's something else called the tamchoy, which is the excess above that. We want to give the aniyim a little more. With that, we're not going to force upon the ashirim, but that's kol ish asher yedvenu libo. Does everybody see that? So you actually get these two dinim of tzedakah that are distinguished in by these two different institutions, the kupa institution and the tamchoy institution, the kupa being the most basic of them. And then he says, he quotes the Rambam, very famous Rambam here in Manos Aniyim Tes Aleph. The Rambam says, Me'olam lo ra'inu v'lo shamanu b'kahal mi'Yisrael she'en lam kupa shel tzedaka, aval tamchoy yesh mekomo sheno agubo v'yesh mekomo shelo no agubo. The Rambam says, every good Jewish community has a kupa, not everybody has a tamchoy. And so the Ma'arik explains, Me'achar de'eno de'ein ela mishum harvacha da'aniyim, yesh mekomo shelo no agubo. The reason why every Jewish town has a kupa is because it's to provide for the basic needs. The reason why not every Jewish town has a tamchoy is because, you know, it's not as important to take care of the excess needs of the aniyim. Let me just close here with one further point. This distinction is pretty much implicit in the Rambam, in Perek Tes Halacha Beis Matnas Aniyim. The Rambam says, for the kupa, Lokhin mikol achad ve'achad mashahu roi litain v'davar hakatsiv alav. V'nosnin l'chol ani v'ani mizonos hamaspikin l'shivas yamim v'zu hi hanikra kupa. So kupa is literally the basic food that people require for 7 days. So I'd say the most elementary needs. And you impose that kifi mashah roi for each ashir to give. The tamchoy, which I'm characterized in halacha beis, is lokhin b'chol yom pas umine machol loperos amos mimisha misnadev lefisha. So it's actually very medirik in the Rambam that it's voluntary for the tamchoy. So it's just very interesting to see these two dinim explicitly distinguished in the Rambam's characterization. And that gives us these two different aspects, the tamchoi versus the kupa. And that's why the most basic one, you're chayiv in right away at shloshim yom, whereas the more extravagant type one only kicks in at a later point. All right. So let's stop here. I want us next year on Tuesday to talk a little more about the things we raised. I want to talk a little more about what's considered in the scope of tzedaka. And then we're going to get deep into our discussion of kfiya on tzedaka, which is what most of the makoros here are going to be about. All right, guys. Shkoyach. All right. Great discussion today. And I'll see you all on Tuesday for regular shiur.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good one. Bye, guys.